deep in London's beating heart lies a wall. How lucky do it be if you know the call? For if the wall steps aside, be not afraid of what you see, 'cause the wizard world is opened up, as has the griffin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Shriekcast, no longer a Harry Potter reread podcast for laughs fans. I'm your host, CeCe.
And I'm Liz.
And Liz, it's been a while. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. The sun's in my eyes, as I think we talked about last time we did this, where like, yep, it's still light out. I should have pulled the curtains before we started.
It's always nice to have a window, but that is the worst feeling. You sit down, you're like, oh, what a beautiful day. I'm going to get some sunlight. And then you realize that you're going to have to close those windows, because if you get that sunlight, it is going right in your damn eyeballs.
That's right.
Did you watch any of the eclipse? Speaking of sun in your eyeballs?
No, what was there to watch? I mean, it was just like cloudy, right?
It was pretty cloudy around here, I guess. Yeah, I like went out and like, but I was like, I'll go outside. I'll see if there's like people milling about in like the park or something, but it wouldn't have been visible.
Yeah, we missed out. I was kind of looking forward to it getting a little dark, because that's obviously what I remember from the last one, where it got very unusually dark. And so I was like, oh, well, this is going to be like that, but less so. And I mean, it was unnoticeable, right? If it became dark at all, it was just the Pacific Northwest gray sky that we are known for. It did dredge up a memory of the last time, like the cool eclipse that happened, and how I was living in an apartment complex, and one of my neighbors graciously put together a playlist to broadcast during the eclipse for everyone around us. So I got to hear all of the like sun themed songs, like Here Comes the Sun and the Marilyn Manson song that goes like, the moon has now eclipsed the sun. I'm sure they had more, but damn.
Black Hole Sun, I'm assuming.
Yeah, probably.
Last time an eclipse happened, I had I like built one of those cool, or I didn't build, like I sent away for like one of those cool like pinhole camera type things, basically, where you could project it onto like a piece of cardboard or whatever, and that was kind of cool.
Neat.
But then I also like, I feel kind of stupid, because like the sunglasses where you actually get to look at it is the coolest thing, because it's just like, if you're looking at it on a piece of cardboard, it's like, man, I got up and like I got excited to like look at like a bit of light on a piece of cardboard. I don't know, not the most exciting thing at the end of the day.
Yeah, but you know, you have to appreciate the cosmic wonder even if it's projected on a piece of cardboard.
Yeah. But no, so we have both been incredibly busy. Let's catch up. What have you been up to all this time?
I have been so busy now that I have two strings groups going on.
Two of them. So I knew that you signed to upgrade it. I didn't realize you were going to both.
Oh, I am going to both, because the director of the program runs both of the groups. And when I got my invite, my special invite, she was like, please don't abandon this group. Please don't go. Come to Thursday, but don't not come to this one. So now I sort of feel like I have to a little bit.
That's a big responsibility.
It is.
That's a lot of strings.
I'm kind of a helper on Wednesdays. And then Thursdays, it's pretty challenging. So not only is my Thursday night occupied, but I have to spend all this time practicing for my Thursday group. Turns out I have to actually practice.
What have you been practicing? What are you working on in the advanced group?
Well, we're playing some classics. Just a little old song you might know called Canon in D.
Let's fucking go.
A classic. We're playing some Bach. I couldn't even tell you which one of his it is. What else are we doing? We're playing the Maple Leaf Reg by Joplin. That's a fun one. And it just sort of gives everyone a part of it, a slice. It slices off parts and hands it all around. It sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
So those are the big name ones for sure. And it's pretty challenging.
That's so cool. So you've moved on to the advanced group. You're still sticking with the intermediate group. How is the intermediate group going?
It's okay. We're hanging in. We actually had one member of our group who was a very strong cello have to drop out for like work conflict reasons. Mm-hmm. So we're hanging on by a thread, trying to keep it going. But we'll see. But it's fun. It's just like funny, like junior high school type music, and it's always sort of nice to just sit down and play something easy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I especially contrasted, I guess, with the more complicated stuff. That's just a lot of strings during the week. I mean, that's awesome, but just like, wow, you've got no time for like WoW dungeons or anything.
I know. It's I've been playing Star Wars: The Old Republic for about 45 minutes every morning before I go to work. But other than that, I'm like, oh, and I've been playing Octopath Traveler for about 45 minutes before I go to bed. But that's like my only non-strings time, really.
Wow. I mean, that's really cool, though. I mean, it's a cool pursuit, just very time consuming, right?
Yeah. And then on top of, like, I have to practice my advanced music quite a bit, but I've also gotten into my head that I need to like memorize some tunes. So I've been working on memorizing some like recognizable songs as like a parlor trick type thing. Like if someone was like, play some violin, and then I could just like bust out the Mario theme, for instance, just off the top of my head. Yeah. So I've been working on that one. I've been working on a couple fiddle tunes, and I've been working on, Star Wars, obviously, like the main theme. Mm-hmm. So that's been a fun little project. Let me know if you can think of any good parlor trick type songs that would be worth memorizing.
When I was a kid, I absolutely did this on trumpet, and I could play the like item getting sound from Zelda.
There you go.
I could play the Fire Emblem theme.
Uh-huh.
And I could, God, there was another one that I just really, really liked doing on the trumpet that was just one. Oh, I could do the ba-da-da bum 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 from Lord of the Rings. Those were like the ones that I could just like, you know, bust out without having the sheet music in front of me or anything.
That's pretty good.
How hard is that for you? How much of a like a sheet music relier are you?
Oh, I'm a big time sheet music relier, which is like partially why I'm doing this, because I'm trying to train myself to be able to play by ear. Mm-hmm. And to cut out the sheet music part from my like ear training to what I'm doing on the violin. So it's like an intonation exercise, especially because it's like I know what the Mario theme sounds like. So I know if it's like a tiny bit wrong, but it's definitely not my strength.
Violin also just like that is a much more complicated. Like I had three buttons to learn, right? Whereas violin is like, I don't know, you got to put your hand like exactly here and press exactly this hard. Yeah, just complicated.
I can play three bars of Mario, so we'll see if I can add to that. I can play Irish Washerwoman, the fiddle tune. That is in Master and Commander, but is not what they are playing in Master and Commander. I think it's like in a background scene and you can like hear it off in the distance a little bit.
They're playing, God, what? They're playing. Great movie. Wow.
Yeah.
I should put that on my Plex. That's what I've been doing. This is what my life has been, other than like scrambling to like release a video game for the dealing with all that. I bought myself a little server and I've been making a Plex. I've been putting movies and TV shows on it and not watching any of them.
That's so fun though. Sometimes it's fun to be the curator, you know?
It's fun to hoard stuff, you know?
Yeah. What are your top recommendations from your catalog?
Top recommendations from my catalog. Gotta be getting all of the Simpsons seasons that I like, and then realizing that they are all really horrible upscaled like widescreen ones where they've like cropped it to fit a new TV, and it just looks like shit. I'm super not watching that version.
Right. Yeah.
I think I'm just going to like buy all the DVDs and rip them myself and just get them in like the quality that I like. That's like really what inspired this is I have like a bunch of boxes of DVDs and Blu-rays sitting around. And I'm just like, I should just rip all of these and put them on a computer somewhere and get rid of all the discs, you know, take them to Goodwill or whatever, and then just like have that space for something else, you know?
Sure. Well, I have two copies of Elfin Lied on DVD, so next time I see you all,
yeah,
I'll pass that along your way.
I'll put that on there. That's the fun thing is I have so much space. I got this little hard drive, this little like 5 terabyte drive, and I can put whatever I want on there. It's great.
You could put whatever shit on there.
I could put Master and Commander on there. In fact, I should do that right now. I should just get Master and Commander going on there.
I will look forward to checking out the catalog. You got to get Buffy on there.
I do. And there's like no good version. You've told me this. There's like no good version of Buffy.
Nope. It's DVDs and that's it.
And they're like, really, aren't they like really old DVDs too? Like they're really like ugly interlaced DVDs. Yeah. That's so crazy to me. Like, I know that like, you know, I know that like some stuff happened with Whedon, but like I'm surprised that there's just no like definitive version of it. It's like the most influential show of its time. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, that's been it. I'm trying to think what's been going on since we last recorded, and the answer is other than just like working, not much. Although I do have one addendum to make, because last time we talked, we talked about a big philosophical topic, the store, going to the store.
Oh yeah,
Who do we like going to the store, etc. I have a new bone to pick with going to the store, which is that a 12er of Diet Coke, $10.99 here now.
That's so messed up.
That is so. What are we doing?
Genuinely, I know I sounded sarcastic, but I meant it. That is so messed up.
That is crazy, right? Like, let's go. I'm rescinding my appreciation of the store. Until the price of Diet Coke gets back to normal. I am not paying $11 every time I am going to get some Diet Coke. That's nuts.
Yeah, that's too much.
I'm becoming old. I'm so old now.
You know what we both just need? We need more goof-off time.
Your goof-off time, you've got 45 minutes of the Old Republic, you know?
Yep.
How much goofing off can you really accomplish in 45 minutes in that game?
Exactly. I pick up my quests, I do one of them, and then I log out.
You're a WoW veteran, you know, World of Warcraft, big fan. Very active game still, very active chat in that.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Old Republic chat like? What are they goofing off and doing?
So it's funny because at first I thought there was going to be like a lot of chat. And it must have just because I was like in areas where there was a lot. And now that I'm like level 40, and I think there's like 70 levels, no one is chatting in the zones that people are leveling in at level 40, right? So there's very, very little chat other than like searching for like some daily heroic something or other. Mm-hmm. But when I was in some of the starter zones, which I was... a few times, because I've started like 3 or 4 characters trying to figure out what I wanted to play. And there was actually like a lot of lore discussion.
Okay. That's kind of cool. They're engaged.
Yeah. There would be like questions like, you know, what happened to this Sith Lord? Did he die? And then people would like have like all these answers and sort of like different perspectives on it. And it was very interesting.
That's fun. They're having fun. That's cool. They're goofing off. They have time to goof off. Ask Star Wars questions. Yeah. We need a designated goof off day every week.
Mm-hmm.
Just playing a game. I don't know. Throwing a ball. there's so many ways to goof off.
Yep, those are the two. Playing some frisbee.
I remember back at college, there were people playing Ultimate, or was it Ultimate? There was a sport people were playing with a Frisbee at our college.
Yeah, I think it was Ultimate Frisbee, yeah.
That's very presumptuous. Ultimate Frisbee?
I know.
I could probably come up with a better Frisbee thing. I don't know. Someone could. Maybe if not me, someone could. You know what? I think this episode, this is going to be our goof off episode.
Absolutely, it is.
Because we are not talking about the Hunger Games this week.
Mm-mm. No, not a serious political thriller like the Hunger Games.
No. Although, funnily enough, maybe more of a political thriller than the Hunger Games so far.
Incredible.
Which is very funny. I'm glad that we were talking a little bit about Star Wars: The Old Republic here, because what a fitting way to bring us into what we're actually reading this week.
Yeah, this week we're reading the first third of a Star Wars Legends novel, mm-hmm. Truce at Bakura.
Truce at Bakura.
And my understanding is that the Legends title is what the Disney is calling all of the old extended universe stuff. Is that right?
Yes. Like, if you go to Wikipedia, you can sort by, like, canon versus legends. And legends is just where they've stuffed all these old books. And then if anything gets brought back into canon, it has a separate tab where you can see, like, what they're currently doing, if they're in the universe at all now.
I kind of like that. I'm kind of a huge fan of that. And I think they should just keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, more tabs. Let's just try again.
to be fair, like, I've been of two minds of this, like, as a Star Wars fan, like, for so long. Because, like, I just think it's so weird to, like, undo, like, years and years of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it was fucking stupid. I will be the first to admit that. And also, like, I remember... It's funny that there is now it's just like the two tabs. It's canon and legends, because I distinctly remember there being kind of a split even when the EU was technically canon, which is that, like, everything was true-ish, but there were, like, tiers. Do you remember people talking about, like, G canon, which was anything that's mm-hmm. in the movies or that George mm-hmm. Lucas had said? And then yes. There was, like, A-tier canon. There was just stuff that was just, like, you know, like, video games were like, this is probably not canon, right? Like, the Star Wars car combat game for the PS1, that's in, like, D canon or whatever. Because it's like, no, I don't think Boba Fett drove a tank, you know, and like, shot Han Solo with it.
Right.
So this is, in a way, cleaner. Yeah, it is still very odd.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of cool. I think people get so, I mean, in a way it does kind of just sort of reaffirm the sanctity of canon, since it's sort of enshrining it and, like, discarding part of it. But I like that canon can just be reinvented, although I assume that if we were to add tabs, for instance, we're not doing the movies over again, which I think that maybe we should try again with some of them.
There's, like, a good half of the Star Wars movies you could take a new crack at, I think, and I would be fine with that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very funny that we're stuck with the prequels and now stuck with the sequels.
But yes, no, I appreciate, because, you know, like, I go back and forth on this, and I think ultimately it always is a case by case basis for me on, like, how much I care about, like, adhering to something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, this is like happening right now with one of your other hobbies, like the Warhammer shit that's going on right now.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
People are mad that by the way, I was reading up on this because I'm not super I enjoy 40K stuff, and I'm like not like I'm by no means like immersed in it. Right.
Uh-huh.
But like, for anyone who doesn't know, there's like a new it's not a chapter. It's like a kind of space marine that can have, like,
I don't think they're technically space marines.
They're
the custodes.
Who are they're like even bigger, more badass space marines,
and
right?
They're beautiful, and they're there to guard the Emperor. And I believe they just spend a lot of time doing, like, combat drills. they play like war games because they're like, what if something happened? And they're big and beautiful and maybe supposed to be in the image of the emperor or something, which is where some of the problem. They were like, what if there was a woman, like woman confirmed as a custode? And people were not very happy with that.
I just can't get it up to care about that, like the sanctity of like the custodes who were made up later anyway, you know?
Right.
Like if you're cool with the custodes existing, then you're already okay with like new stuff being added to the lore, right? So like, okay, so now there's women ones, who gives a fuck? So it's worth being elastic.
Yes,
I have mixed feelings on it, and I think most of that has to do with like how the new canon has been handled more than...
Oh, because it sucks ass?
Because it sucks ass. It is like just as stupid as the old, like making the exact same mistakes, but in record time, you know?
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, I will not shed any tears for the loss of the Yuuzhan Vong, you know?
Sure.
But you got to replace it with something cooler, and they have not done that at all. Yeah, it's weird. I sometimes care and sometimes I don't, and it's very inconsistent, and maybe it's a little hypocritical sometimes. I'm trying to think of like other stuff like Star Wars that has like an established canon that's relevant to this. Did you read any of the Halo novels ever?
I did not.
No. The Halo novels, I think those are all 3-star bangers. You know, there's like,
oh yeah, hell yeah.
They, you know, they're not amazing literature, but they are really fun, and they've got great lore. And the Halo TV show really did piss me off with how much it just completely ignored and just, like just didn't do anything cool with any of that stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The sanctity of canon, I think, really has to do with like, did changing it do something worthwhile? And if the answer is yes, I don't give a shit. If the answer is you made it worse or it's just as bad, like with Star Wars, then I don't know. Then I start getting like, well, why bother? Right. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Star Wars really fumbled it pretty much immediately, which is impressive.
So Truce of Bakura, this novel, to kind of bring us back to that, is it was not the first expanded universe novel by a long shot, but it was part of that wave in the early 90s, kind of around the time that the special editions had been announced.
Right.
So, like, we're talking around the time of, like, the Dark Empire comics, the Shadows of the Empire video game, the Thrawn trilogy, I think, had just come out, which are Star Wars books that I remember really enjoying.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read the Thrawn books?
I did not, actually. I know, like, everything that happened in them, or at least have at some point, right? My memory is not great of the synopses that I have read, and they sound badass, but no, I've never actually read them.
Yeah, I think they're great. They've actually, funnily enough, Timothy Zahn, the author of those, is, like, heavily involved with, like, the current expanded universe stuff, and, like, the post-Disney canon. And rewrote the trilogy more or less with like a canon compliant version. Like, that's how beloved those are, I guess, is there are now like new canon compliant versions of the same story.
Wow.
Which is kind of fun. But Truce of Bakura, so like when you think of like the Star Wars expanded universe and you think of like the stuff I was growing up with reading, it was the New Jedi Order and it was the X-Wing books.
Right.
That I was really invested in as a kid. Truce of Bakura completely passed me by. I didn't know about it. You were the one who asked me if I knew about this novel.
Uh-huh.
And I'd never heard of it before. Do you want to give us like a little intro to like what is the Truce of Bakura? What is this? Who wrote it? Where does it fit in the story, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. So The Truce of Bakura was a novel that I was obsessed with as a kid, and they didn't have it at my local library, which is very sad, and it was hard to track down. So I'd never actually read it. I read like synopses of it since then and all of that, but this is my first like true read through of it. And the reason that I was so obsessed with it as a kid is because it picks up right after Return of the Jedi. It is the direct sequel, and we'll get into how direct once we get to actually talking about what we've read. And that was like so exciting to me as a kid, because I was just like, I don't want the movies to be over. They're so good. Oh, well, there's a book that just picks up right where you left off.
Yes. This is the like Aladdin 2 Prince of Thieves for Return of the Jedi. It is like it is the closest to a direct, like, especially like considering this is from 1993, so you know, before even Phantom Menace, this is like the closest you can get to like here is Star Wars 7.
Yeah.
Which is a funny for a lot of reasons. One, we have a Star Wars 7 now, and it was fine, I guess. And we have we have a ton, of course there was tons of other expanded universe stuff, but I think it's my main impression of this reading it so far is that like this is, even by sort of the standard of the Star Wars universe, like where, you know, this is where like Han Solo had a fist fight with like a giant otter.
Mm-hmm.
And like fought the Terminator and like a bunch of other, this is really weird. It's a really weird book, and it's a really weird thing to be the sequel to Return of the Jedi. And I think it's going to be really fun to talk about. And I think it's going to be like, you know, no, we propose this as just sort of like a palate cleanser between Hunger Games novels.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that this is actually going to be like a really relevant read and discussion for us, because just looking at it as like the direct sequel to Return of the Jedi and a piece of like the really, really lucrative Star Wars expanded universe stuff, and just as like part of like the project of Star Wars, the fact that Star Wars is just like inescapable as a media property.
Mm-hmm.
It is the kind of thing that all of the other stuff we have read that hasn't been Harry Potter has avoided doing. You know, Twilight has not done this. The Hunger Games has not done this, right? Those are very tightly controlled. And then WB has sort of been trying to get this kind of story off the ground with Harry Potter, and just hasn't done anything with that sort of thing. That we know, we're not getting like yearly Harry Potter novels from different sci-fi authors, right? Like that's right. Just not the kind of, and so I think that there is something interesting here to just like look at how malleable a property is and see how it's being exploited and kind of get a sense of like this is the sort of like mid these are the loud mids that like other novels just or other franchises often don't get going.
Mm-hmm.
that sort of like drag these properties like into the future for better or worse, right? I do just find that kind of like just it fascinating as like a concept.
Yeah, totally.
Like, is it worth it, you know? Do you like this?
I guess I would say I think someone could have written a better Star Wars 7 or whatever it would have been. That is more Star Wars than this.
Mm-hmm.
I like this kind of story in Star Wars because that's sort of the whole exciting thing about universes like this, is you can tell all sorts of stories in it. It is strange that it has Han, Luke, and Leia in it. Overall, I'm going to say good for Star Wars, yes.
Yeah. Like, I have mixed feelings about the concept of the Forever story, but I do think that it's, like, it's interesting to read this kind of thing and to see what people want to do with characters, like if given the opportunity to, like, write more about them, right? And I can't help but think about like when I'm reading this, like what is it about Star Wars or any other, because like Star Trek had this kind of novel as well, like tons and tons of them. Or like how Buffy, which we were talking about earlier, has like a million comics that are like still running, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And like that, you know, those stories are still going. And like, what does it take to make that happen well? And do you think in a few years' time or a decade's time or whatever, we will be getting these for like current franchises that are like kind of done now? Like are we going to see this for Hunger Games? Are we going to see this for Harry Potter? Are we going to see, like, it's Star Wars is just like the one that has like really succeeded with this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to see like the work that needs to go into making something last forever, right? Like,
right.
And like what needs to be done to the story, and like what sort of concessions you need to make for like your view of the characters. I'm fascinated. I ended up being way more fascinated by this book than I thought I was going to. I mean, like, I knew I was going to have fun with it, but like way more thinking about like the bigger implications of like sequel to Return of the Jedi.
Right. Yeah.
And like comparing this to Cursed Child and how Cursed Child like really didn't take off. I mean, like a huge financial success, but like we're not getting like the continued adventures of those characters. We're not getting the new Jedi Order for Albus Severus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like what makes it work? Kind of an open-ended, bizarre question, but yeah, that's what this book is making me think about at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they approached a hard sci-fi writer to write the next chapter in Luke's adventure. I feel like franchises are going to be more tightly controlled, and that Star Wars at the time that this book came out, I don't think that a huge franchise would ever be in that weird spot in time that this could happen again.
It was just like right place, right time for something like this.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it had the advantage of like already being like one of the biggest media franchises of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So like, of course you could write anything and it would be successful, but like they made a go of it. And I feel like I think I'm thinking about this because I think we are in that window now. You know, that would have been 1993, so it would have been, God, it's actually crazy to think about how that, actually not that long. It's like 77 to 93, so like 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of crazy to think about. Like that, yeah. That really wasn't that long, but like that is the position that we are in with them like trying to get these fucking Fantastic Beasts dog shit movies off the ground and trying to mm-hmm. get like we're in, I think that's why I'm thinking about it. Like we are in that moment with other franchises now, and I just don't know if it's gonna happen. I don't think it's gonna happen, right?
Like I don't think it's gonna happen. I feel like with the way hugely successful franchises are, they're either going to invest money to make something better than this,
mm-hmm.
or they're going to be like, you can pry it from our cold, dead hands.
Yeah. Like what's the closest thing to this? I think Warhammer actually might be the closest thing to this right now. You have a stable of like moderately successful sci-fi novels that are just kind of rotating between sci-fi authors, right? And like
there are so many novels, so many.
Yeah, but Warhammer I think has the advantage of all kind of starting there, right? Like it was always a kind of like collaborative's the wrong word, right? But it was always being contributed to by like tons and tons of different people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Star Wars like started as a very singular thing that sort of got passed off to other people, and I don't know if we'll see that again here.
Right. Yeah.
Even with things where it probably could have, like, if there were like Pan Am novels, you know, mm-hmm. I think that could have worked. Probably there probably could be a cottage industry of like, here's what's going on in this state that we never talked about in that novel.
Mm-hmm. This is going to be such a stupid question.
Mm.
Does Marvel have novels?
They did. They did for a while. I don't know if they still do them.
And was it Marvel Comics that had novels, or was it Marvel Cinematic Universe novels?
Oh, sure. So the thing that I was going to bring up was Marvel absolutely did have novels, and they might have even been like novel. I don't know if they were original or if they were like summaries of like comic arcs, right? Because I remember this now. I had a Spider-Man novel. I had the Spider-Man Sinister Six omnibus, but I don't know if that was like an original story with those characters or if that was like summarizing a comic arc. But the thing that I think is important to note is that it came out like 1995. So like right when the Star Wars Expanded Universe stuff was like really fucking hitting, you know?
Right, yeah.
I wonder if that was like, maybe that's the most that this kind of thing has happened is in like specifically the wake of the Expanded Universe, right?
Right.
YA is obviously going strong and whatnot, but just like this kind of thing, the adult oriented franchise book. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's really hitting anymore.
Yeah.
I'll have to think. I need to go on a deep dive of like franchise novel. I mean, like I'm fascinated by this stuff. Like I bought all the Mass Effect books when those were coming out. I like the Halo novels, obviously, and I think those are still going, but again, like that is just so much more niche now, I think.
Yeah, but that if they're still going, I mean, that's like has become a fandom of its own.
Yeah, totally. Totally unto itself type thing. But just like thinking about like what our giant media franchises are right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the novels are like the we're getting TV shows, right? They're making 10 million Walking Dead shows. They're not like it's not like the Walking Dead extended universe stuff would be novels if that show had come out like 20 years earlier. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so interesting to think about that. If anyone listening has any burning opinions on this or recommendations for like weird rabbit holes to go down for novels, please let me know. I would love to know what the state of like the tie-in paperback is.
I do want to take a minute to talk about Kathy Tyers, who
wrote
the novel, which is another exciting thing that you mentioned to me, where we haven't had an author in a while who's like quite a character.
Yeah.
And she really is. She's like your kind of a little bit of just an old school science fiction writer. And she was approached to write this novel. I don't have any context for that beyond her saying that in a few interviews. She has written one other like trilogy and then some like other couple books. Her other trilogy, she wrote, I think in the 80s. And the first book is called Firebird. I think she wrote Firebird and then she later went back and rewrote it and then wrote a couple sequels to it. And her thing is that she's like mega Christian and she's big into Christian science fiction specifically, and has won a few like Christian and evangelical science fiction awards, which is interesting, and I'm excited to find out how that sort of what pops up in Truce at Bakura.
Yeah, well, there's the added wrinkle to that too, which is not only is she, I mean, like she is like capital C Christian, like not just like an author who happens to be, like it is her whole personality. If you go to her website, if you read her interviews, like she is preaching constantly. She is a very, very outwardly religious person. But the thing that makes that so interesting, and I've been noticing this while reading as well, is that she's also a biologist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she has a like her master's in microbiology or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. She is like a very scientifically educated writer, and that like comes across in this book like very clearly.
Yeah,
there's a lot of like of sort of like hard sci-fi concepts in this that we'll talk about when we get into the book, but I find that such a fascinating combination with like a very outwardly evangelical Christian writer. Yeah, fascinating author. I can't wait to read more of the book. I had a great time with the first seven chapters of this, but yeah, she is truly interesting. Like, that's been one of the biggest, you know, huge respect to Susan Collins for staying out of the spotlight.
Mm-hmm,
I totally get
sure.
it. I would do the same. But God, I love being able to read about like Mr. Too Damn gets in trouble with Dan Brown, or reading about Stephanie Meyer's K-pop playlists, right? Like I love getting a picture of the author, and we have a great picture of the author going into this. A classic hard sci-fi author / devout Christian offered the direct sequel to the original Star Wars trilogy.
Incredible. Yeah, she's interesting. She's done a lot of stuff. Like, she has like, she's like a flutist. Mm-hmm. She has like a like two folk albums that she did with her late husband, which I can only find one song from on like a YouTube channel that's dedicated to like lost music of Montana or something that someone just like ripped from a tape.
It's so cool.
And then she like came back to writing and went back to and was a teacher for a while and all this stuff. So she's really interesting, an interesting person.
Interesting person, and someone who like someone who like I don't agree with at all, but it's fascinating to read interviews with. Like, her there are several questions in interviews with her where they're like, you know, you're a devout Christian and stuff, but you write science fiction, and she's like, yeah, that was really tough for me. She's stuck in this very interesting place as a writer of like too outwardly evangelical, I think, for like what you would consider like the like sci-fi, hard sci-fi, like literati now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but also like I think she does seem a little too hard sci-fi for like the evangelical, more devoted to exploring religion than Stephanie Meyer was, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But also perhaps more interested in dealing with science fiction and things that might be unpalatable to that audience than Stephanie Meyer was. It's very,
yes.
Very, very fascinating.
Yeah.
So do you wanna get into it? Should we talk about The Truce of Bacora, chapters 1-7?
Yeah, let's do it. I do have a summary for us. I know that it's not necessary because I'm sure everyone has read this novel cover to cover many times.
This is such a famous part of the Star Wars universe.
It's such a famous part, but just in case someone is not familiar with Truce at Bacora, I figured it would help to know what's going on. I tried to keep this as brief as possible. In chapter one, the return of the Jedi Ewok party is still going on when we catch up with Luke, who is returning to the Rebel Alliance cruiser in orbit around Endor. He rescues Wedge, who found himself in a sticky situation out in space where he triggered a like Imperial probe that was on its way to the recently defeated Empire HQ. Luke just can't shake these spells of horrible, horrible pain also, and is advised by a medical droid that he must rest from the effects of the Palpatine lightning that just happened. Luke attends the briefing about the Imperial drone ship. It contained a distress call addressed to the Emperor himself from a governor on a planet called Bacora, who is under attack by aliens. The rebel commanders put their heads together and realize if they go and help Bacora, they could potentially bring them into the Alliance, since the Empire won't be helping them anytime soon. And they have great technology that would be a great boon to them. It's decided that Han and Leia and a strike force will go to Bacora to do some diplomacy. Chapter 2, Luke is resting and kind of moping that he's not going on the big mission, but right after he goes to sleep, he is awoken by Obi-Wan Kenobi Force Ghost, who tells him he definitely has to go on the mission to Bakura, and the Alliance leaders agree, because what are you going to do? Luke ends up getting command of the carrier ship, and it's off to Bakura. We are introduced in a point of view scene to a character named Dev, who is assisting in a procedure carried out by his master, who is an alien that looks like a dinosaur. And he's helping calm down a prisoner who is undergoing a sinister procedure. And we kind of get the idea that the prisoner's brain power is being extracted and put into droids. And Dev is being used because he's force sensitive and is able to calm them down. Chapter 3. Luke's strike force arrives in the Bakura system and comes upon a space battle between Imperial ships and the alien invaders. It's not going well for the Imperials. Luke hails them and offers them aid, and they have no choice but to accept. Han and Leia take the Millennium Falcon away to safety in preparation for the battle. Luke prepares to enter the battle, but instead we catch up with Han and Leia, who are hiding out on the sixth moon. Leia is anxious about Luke's safety and is also reflecting on how horrible it is that Darth Vader was her dad. Han lures her into a cargo bay where he has a bottle of wine from Endor, and Chewbacca has set up a romantic nest of pillows for them. Fade to black. Chapter 4. Chewbacca hails Han, much to Han's displeasure, as he is still lounging about with Leia. But they are being approached by hostiles, which are a bunch of weird droids that C-3PO can't really identify. Han shoots them all from the gun part of the ship, and they go to help Luke out in his big space battle. And what a space battle it is. There's plenty of action and all sorts of logistics, and Wedge is out there doing some shooting and some fighting. Luke has to reckon with the burden of command when he feels the deaths in the Force, and on and on. Luke does a maneuver where he force reaches out to one of the alien ships and, like, makes it crash into another by convincing it that it's the right thing to do. Han swoops in and saves Luke from some enemy ships in a classic Han Solo type move, and they have won the day. The Imperials thank them, and they have secured their safe landing on Bakura to meet the politicians. Chapter 5, we begin from the point of view of a Bakuran senator. The Senate is convening along with the governor, who she doesn't like very much, Governor Nereus. When she learns that the Rebel Alliance ships have shown up, she is not exactly pleased, remembering that the last time there was a rebellion, it was put down violently and her parents were killed in the crossfire. We learn a little bit about her. She's very religious and believes in the balance, and she thinks that if those darn politicians can't decide on a grade school curriculum, how in the heck will they agree about serious topics like taxation? Next, we catch up with Dev, who we remember was with the dinosaur aliens, who senses presumably Luke's presence in the Force and is compelled by his strength that reminds him of his mother, which is something that he hadn't felt since he was a child. Chapter 6. Han and Leia and Luke argue about what ship they're going to take down to Bakura, and somehow Han wins and they take the Millennium Falcon. Leia is taking the lead on this mission, and she has everyone dressed up in their formals. The first person they meet is the Imperial Governor Nereus. Leia informs him that Emperor Palpatine is dead and that Vader killed him, but also that Vader is dead too. Leia communicates their mission statement. They are looking to reestablish the old Republic and the Jedi Order. They travel for a little while, observing the environs, and then they arrive at the building where they do politics. There are a bunch of stormtroopers around, making them uneasy. They're forced to check their weapons in a locker, and Chewie stays behind to guard the weapons. Chapter 7. Leia has received her meeting with the senators and Governor Nereus in attendance. Luke feels Gayriel's presence, which was the lady that we had that POV chapter with, the senator, in the Force, and it's not that she's Force-sensitive or anything, but her presence is just, like, so beautiful and deep. Meanwhile, Leia tells the senators that she and the Alliance are friends of the Imperial-ruled people, just not friends of the Empire, and they, in response, ask her if she even knows what they're up against, and show them a video of Dev, who is narrating a broadcast explaining how the Siruk, who are the dinosaur aliens, are going to capture everyone and siphon off their brain energy into droids, and that's really great. We kind of jump POVs back to Gariel, who is just not so sure about these rebels, but she listens as Leia delivers a speech. Leia recounts her history as the daughter of an Imperial governor who helped the rebellion and how the Empire rules by fear and intimidation, but that they were here to help. When Leia mentions Luke, Gariel's attention immediately goes to the handsome Jedi and the spiritual complications that arise from that. Leia lays it all out. They have to accept their help or they might all get turned into droids. Finally, the senators agree to help to set them up with quarters and release data files to them about the Sirook. As they are leaving the Senate chamber, they encounter an Imperial officer that Leia recognizes as being from Alderaan. They approach him and have just sort of a friendly introduction, and Han wants to shoot him so much that his hand is on his blaster and his trigger finger is barely disengaged. Luke does a force persuade on him to calm him down, and Han tells him to never do that again. And that was the end of our reading.
That was a very good summary. Thank you. That was kind of that's the longest amount of book we've ever really had to cover in one of these, I think.
Yeah.
First of all, just letting that really sit with me for a moment, as this is what happens after they're singing Yub Nub at the end of Return of the Jedi. This is what's happening. 15 minutes after the Emperor dies, this is what they're doing. That's so awesome to think about. So I just kind of like broadly at the top here, I want to ask you something about like the tone and like, or not even the tone, more I guess the stakes of the story here. Mm-hmm. Does this not feel more like a Star Trek story to you than Star Wars?
Totally, yeah. Absolutely a Picard diplomacy mission, right?
Yeah, it's so funny because the threat is the Borg. It's the dinosaurs are making the Borg, right? Yep. They are. Mm-hmm. But having these characters go on a diplomatic mission, and we're meeting all these characters that have like kind of very established politics that they're going to have to contend with, it just feels very much unlike a Star Wars story, which I think is one of those things. It's like both like the advantage of having something like the expanded universe where you can kind of do whatever you want with these characters and put them in different kinds of situations and different kinds of stories, but also this being the sequel to Return of the Jedi, like a big flashy adventure movie, it's very funny to imagine like Luke getting back to the ship and finding out that he has like a very like hard sci-fi bone disease he has to recover from because of the light. Like just really, really hard tone whiplash there.
Yeah, he has this hard sci-fi bone disease. He has to contend with the burden of command and how he should really be out there with the soldiers. He's got to put his formals on.
He's got to put his formals on, and he's got to use a like tactical computer that's like a big part. That's another very Star Trek-y thing. He's got like a device that he's got to like look at the ship's computer for a bunch of the battle. The summary I think actually is interesting to listen to because it makes it feel more action packed than I think the book actually has felt so far. Because it is such a logistical story, right?
Yeah.
Like, all of these battles are taking place, like, in the command room with Luke sort of, like, having information relate to him. And it's all, like the most un-Star Wars thing ever of, like, having those characters, like, hail them and be like, we need you to send a... What is it? Like an escape cone. Of ships in between these two flanks, and that might press free. Like, it's very, very tactical stuff. It is not just like you get to watch the X-Wings fly around and do cool stuff. It is like Master and Commander novel type. Here's some like naval terms. Here's some Air Force terms for you. It's very, very odd for Star Wars, I think.
Yeah, it's funny that It's funny that the summary that I wrote makes it seem more action-packed, and I think you're right, because I wrote it in such a way that it sounds like an adventure action sequence, because I literally just skipped over all the logistics, right? Because I'm not going to sit here. I just breezed on past them. No, thank you. I will simply talk about the time that Luke made one crash into another one. That's like the action part.
Which is crazy, by the way.
It's crazy.
He told that droid, you know, it would be better to like kill yourself and others than to like fight me. And the droid was like, yeah, okay. You got a point.
Yep. And it was just like, that's normal. That's fine. Yeah. We're just moving right along from that.
Yeah, crazy scene.
That's some Hera using the Imperius curse stuff to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a crazy thing that Luke did there. That I guess he didn't say it, but he kind of implied it, right?
He did. He was like, what, isn't it better to die? Or something.
It was like, it's better to die honorably than or it's like, he does the, you know, he does the Star Wars version of better to die on your feet than live as a soldier, you know, live as a pawn, right? Mm-hmm. And the droid apparently is just like, yeah, no arguments there, and just not only like doesn't just disengage from the fight, which I think might have been more appropriate, maybe, like if it just flew away, it just like takes out a bunch of its buddies with it, like
yeah,
it just switches sides and blows up. Very, very, very dark, because it's like that's a human brain in there. Due to the entechment, which is another, again, a very Star Trek thing, or just maybe more. I mean, like it gives me feelings of the Borg, but really, it's just another like very hard sci-fi concept, science fiction novel concept of they are putting human minds into these droids and like kind of throwing the bodies away and putting them in more powerful bodies and using those as their army, which, you know, classic sci-fi novel stuff, but not very Star Warsy, I don't think.
No, not at all.
And the thing that does make it Star Warsy is that the guys doing it are a bunch of dinosaurs, which does make it kind of awesome, I think.
Yeah, it does.
So let's talk about the Sea Rook. They're kind of cool.
They're super cool.
They're just fucking straight. They're just dinosaurs. They are just straight up dinosaurs.
Yeah, they're like cool raptors, and their speech is like singing like a bird. And I think that Kathy said something about that, like specifically like a scientific angle of it. Like, well, birds evolved from dinosaurs, so like dinosaurs would probably have like a sing-song birdsong language.
Very, very cool. Very cool world building. I like the concept of them a lot. I have to say that was one of my first like, oh, this is a very interesting author moments, was reading that interview. Mm-hmm. Where she points out that like, oh, well, the current like hottest scientific theory is that the dinosaurs evolved from birds. I'm like, aren't you an evangelical? Like, right. you're not like you're cool with this. Just very weird, very interesting, you know. Very conservative Christian worldview, it seems like, but like also very scientifically minded, right? It just fascinating.
Yeah,
the thing that makes them a lot more like Jim Henson Creature Workshop than just being dinosaurs, though, is that they have tongues that come out of their nostrils.
Yeah.
And like feel stuff. That's how they're feeling and smelling stuff, is they have like these wiggly tentacles that come out of their nose and then touch
it's
everything.
So cool.
It's very, very cool, very weird. I can imagine the puppet, you know, like they do at least feel, I think, quite Star Warsy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very, very, very odd. Their goal is to spread to the Sea Rook Imperium, you know, has ambitions to spread across the galaxy, you know, and to subjugate humanity and to put them all in their like brain network. Stop me if you've heard this one before. There is a alien threat that wants to unite humanity into like a robot system. Classic hard sci-fi, or not even hard, just classic sci-fi stuff that just feels so out of place in Star Wars, I think. Which never in the movies really dealt with like this kind of thing. I think that like that's the weakest part of the story so far, but it does make for like an interesting political position for the story to be taking place, or like political thriller positioning kind of like around because of this conflict, which is that the Emperor is dead and Bakura, which is an Imperial vassal, sent out a distress signal that the rebels intercepted, and they decide they're going to go and like do a PR appearance basically.
Yeah.
To be like, hey, well, you know, we killed the Emperor, but we'll help out because we're good. And I like that a lot as a premise. But you were completely spot on. It is a Picard doing diplomacy plot, right? Mm-hmm. This is a Star Trek premise.
Yeah, it really is. And I do you feel like the characters, because we're jumping right in with Luke, Han, and Leia. It is a direct sequel to Return of the Jedi. Do you think that they feel like fish out of water in this story?
I think that is the part that makes it feel the weirdest, is that we kind of get some lip service from like Luke's internal monologue to like how weird he feels like being like a commander for the first time, right? And like the responsibility he feels. Which is funny because I was thinking about this because it takes place right after the films, it's not like we're not meeting different versions of these characters who have like had time and stuff change them, right? Like there's a line in here that made me go like, oh right, that was true, which is where Han mentions that he's a general, right? And it's like right at the beginning of the book, and I'm like, oh right, he does say that in Return of the Jedi. He is technically, he was given the rank of general. But that doesn't really matter in the movie because he's still just doing like romantic adventure movie shit in it, right?
Right,
he's tapping a guy on the shoulder so Chewie can knock them, you know, he's just doing cool guy stuff. But this book is leaning much more into like they are using those ranks, they are using those positions. And it definitely took me a while to get used to the idea of like Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, and Leia, Princess Leia, like hanging out in a briefing room, getting like talking about tactics, right? Like even though they are technically all military characters with ranks and stuff, just diving into it like Tom Clancy novel style is very weird.
Yeah, I mean, they're given the ranks like almost as a convenience in the movies, as like a pat on the back. Like, of course, Han Solo would be a general. He did this like heroic, amazing thing, right? But then as soon as it's like, well, actually, we were just making you general to be nice. Like, you shouldn't be, like, this guy shouldn't be doing general stuff.
Yeah, he did not go through officer school.
No,
right?
who is this guy? And I think that like I mentioned it in my summary because I thought it was so weird, but the like comedy routine they do when they're deciding, like Han is trying to argue that they should take the Millennium Falcon down to the planet instead of like a normal ship, is, and he like wins the argument. I'm like, that's such a not, that would never happen in Star Trek. And we're here in a Star Trek story.
That is so funny. That is so funny. Just imagining, like, so this guy is a general. He is one of the, you know, like the hardest to achieve ranks in like any military, you would hope, right? And he's going like, I think we should drive my pickup truck to the meeting. And everyone has to take him seriously, you know. It's just, it's so surreal. I think the Han Solo in particular is funny in this book because he is split between having to do all this like military science fiction stuff, but also I think he is the most like of the three main characters, he is the one who feels the most like he is being written exactly as he is in the movies. Like, he's saying his catchphrases a lot. He's giving people nicknames. He's, like, saying one-liners all the time. And it's, like, it's not even bad. Like, it's very recognizably the character of Han Solo, right? It's just that it does make you realize that the character of Han Solo... And this isn't a criticism. This is just like the kind of movie that Star Wars is. He's very thin as a character, right? Mm-hmm. He's a gruff bastard who has a heart of gold, and he's a smart aleck, and that's kind of all you get in those movies. Because he's the support guy. But we're getting so much more of him here, and he's being involved in so many more important decisions, and he's still just acting like that guy. It's very funny.
Well, what better plot to give him some depth than a jealous of Luke, who is his girlfriend's brother?
Yeah.
That stuff has only just begun. We're just like getting a little bit of that so far, but it's very funny.
But like, Leia explained that situation to him in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, that was resolved already.
That was resolved. So I don't know why he's getting jealous. There is, I will say, I think one of the funniest, like just chapter one, right off the bat, there was this thing that made me laugh out loud, which was Luke wistfully thinking about Leia and going like, damn, I wish she wasn't my sister.
I'm so glad that you picked that part out too, because I couldn't get over it. I thought it was so funny. He's like, I used to think, but not anymore, ... And then so funny.
Yeah, I've got it here. Leia was down on Endor's surface in the Ewok village. Luke hadn't known she was listening in, but he should have assumed... Oh, by the way, there's another aspect to this that is very funny, which is that Leia and Luke are like on a Skype call all the time in this book. Uh-huh. Just with the Force. They are Skyping each other. He reached out through the Force and brushed his sister's warm presence, sensing justifiable tension. Leia was allegedly resting with Han Solo, recovering from the blaster burn on her upper arm, and helping the furry little Ewoks bury their dead, not watching for new trouble. Luke pursed his lips. He'd loved Leia all along, wishing... ... Well, that was behind him. The intelligence droid answered her over a subspace radio comm link. So he's just like, oh well, that's enough of that. Very weird.
It's so good.
Very, very funny moment. Also a great summation of how funny this book's like place in the story and tone is. The like, oh yeah, the after winning the battle, like Luke and Leia, or Leia and Han were helping bury Ewoks. It's one of those things where you're just like, yeah, I guess. It's just like unforced error setting a story here where you like have to answer questions that like I wouldn't have asked if you hadn't like told me that something happened right after that, you know? Like, yeah, I mean, I guess someone's got to help bury them, but
well, don't worry, we didn't forget about Leia's blaster burn. I think it comes up twice.
That's right. Yes. Well, a lot of lingering wounds in this book. Luke really is going through the ringer because of he got his bones burned.
yeah, he did. And they'll calcify if he doesn't rest. And if he doesn't rest and they calcify, he'll have to go in the tank again. And he'll have Bacta breath all over again.
That is the funniest excuse for this. Like I think it is interesting to sort of keep Luke out of commission with owie bones. That's totally fine. What I do think is funny is that the story does have to again contend with the fact that these are like goofy ass adventure movies, and that in the second movie Luke just sort of like got to chill in a big tank of water for a day and then be completely healed of his ailments, right? And the answer as to why he doesn't do that is that because he's like, no, Yoda told me that painkillers are bad.
Yeah.
Yoda was like getting on anti-vax shit with Luke on Dagobah. He was like, don't trust Fauci, do I? Don't believe you should be taking painkillers. No, pain isn't real.
Just suffer through it. Pain is weakness leaving the body. Like, just...
He just doesn't... Like, that's the only reason that he's, like, not taking the Bacta, which seems like a miracle science fiction drug that heals you of your bone problems.
Yeah.
Very funny. Yeah, the portrayal, having to portray Star Wars adventure movie characters in a political thriller, in such close proximity to them doing decidedly not political thriller stuff is just inherent comedy. Like, it just immediately is difficult to find them in this situation, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, like, another funny, thing that makes it at odds is when Luke is, like, visited by Obi-Wan Kenobi Force Ghost, and then he has to go and tell the, like, Alliance leaders that a ghost visited him, so he has to go on the mission, and they're just like, oh, okay. Like, that's very not political thriller to me. That is just, like, yeah, that's adventure. Like, of course they're gonna listen to him, right?
Yeah. That is so fucking funny. So Obi-Wan appearing... Like, this is the most, like this is sort of, like, ruining the movie a bit, I think. Like, the end of Return of the Jedi, the whole, you know, the trilogy is resolved, and Luke is partying with the Ewoks, and he looks over that balcony, and he sees the ghost of his father and Obi-Wan sort of smiling at him from a distance. There's, like, a finality to that, I think, in the movie, right? Like,
yeah.
That story has come full circle. Like you don't need the Force Ghosts anymore, right? But it would turn out that 15 minutes later, Obi-Wan would be, like, sitting on his bed going, like, you've got to go to Bakura. You've got another adventure to do. And the fact that, like, Mon Mothma and Admiral Ackbar hear that and are like, yeah, no, that sounds good. That makes sense to us. Very, very funny.
I'm trying to remember if in the direct-to-VHS sequel to The Lion King, The Lion King 2, Simba's Pride, I don't think that Mufasa showed up again to be like, Simba, you must accept Kovu as part of your family. Like, I think the Mufasa appearing in the clouds thing was just done.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to look this up. Mufasa, Lion King 2. Does he show up? No. No, that's a one and done. I'm sending you some files. I'm sending you an important picture. Is this from The Lion King 2? Did they do that?
I think he's like, yep, that's totally what it is. Simba has accepted Kovu and invited him into his family and invited the, like, outcast lions back into the pride. And then I think this is, like, the final shot of the movie where it shows Mufasa, like, smiling down at him.
Oh, okay. That makes... No, okay. Yeah, that's fine. They're just doing it again, right? Like, or in fact, no, this is... Note for note what the Return of the Jedi one is to me, which is that it's the closing thing. They just sort of, like, look at each other and smile and be like, you went on that adventure. You did the right thing, right?
Right. Yeah.
He's not coming back to be like, I've got another movie for you.
I've got another message.
there's some crazy shit going on with dinosaurs, actually. It's wild. You're not going to believe this. The other thing too I'm totally willing to accept this just 'cause, like, where this is, like, taking us pretty fun and, like, interesting as a like political thriller, but the flimsiest part of this whole thing, I think, is the involvement of the Emperor. Like, the invocation of the Emperor has been like, oh yeah, he was dealing with dinosaur guys.
I don't get it at all.
I would pay anything. I would give up anything, any material possession possible, to see a scene of Emperor Palpatine dealing with, like, a dinosaur diplomat. I would do anything to see that. It's so vaguely explained. It's like, yeah, he's sort of like playing both sides, because the Bacorans are kind of under imperial quote unquote protection. They're like an imperial vassal state, but also Palpatine is dealing with the Ciruvi dinosaurs, and he like gave them, what is it? He gave them a bunch of droids. He gave them the droids, right? Like the
No, I thought he gave them prisoners.
Oh, that's right. Yes. No, he's giving them prisoners to put
in exchange for their weird little droids.
In
or
exchange
something.
For the droids, because he wants to use it, or he wants the Entekment tools or something. Part of his could this be part of Project Necromancer, perhaps? Is this all
perhaps.
Dark Empire stuff?
Perhaps.
But very funny to imagine Emperor Palpatine like ringing up some dinosaur guys and be like, I've got a great offer for you. I would love to meet with your dinosaur crew. I've got a great idea. I'm fascinated by like it's just the way that this has to kind of bend over backwards to like involve Star Wars characters in it is very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some like interesting stuff going on, like once you kind of get over that hump, I think. What do you think of like the Rebels' plan here to like jump in and be like, hey, we'll do it.
Very politically strategic of them.
Yeah.
They're the good guys. But boy, did the Bacorans have this repulsor lift technology.
Yes, that is so boring. Again, another thing that like if this was in Star Trek, it'd be boring positive, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in Star Wars, that is boring negative. I don't care who gets the better elevator making technology.
Yeah, if you're writing a Star Wars thing and you're like, your bent is to end up more in the Star Trek realm, you just got to take every like element like that and just like crank it up 100%. They've got crystals that blow up a galaxy. Like when we got to get those,
it's tough. Cause like there's definitely good, there are Star Wars stories that deal with like more kind of murky or like more like quote unquote boring political aims that I find really good. I mean, like the Thrawn trilogy has a lot of that. Andor has a lot of that, but here it is so funny because it is like, The most important thing after the death of the Emperor of the Galaxy couldn't possibly be like a better kind of elevator, you know? Like <that's>, like a better carburetor for your land speeder. I don't know. Like it's not a thrilling prospect. You know, if this was like a conspiracy that, I don't know, Boba Fett was uncovering, that would be one thing. But for Luke Skywalker, this to be like the next thing on his docket, that is very funny.
Yeah, General Solo.
General Solo, who is a general, and we will be making use of that in this story. We will be drawing attention to that, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's very all over the place in a way that is like charming, but also just like the thing that makes it work for me, I think, is that the moment to moment stuff. And I think the characters involved are really fun. I like the fact that they're having to like hail Imperials who don't have an emperor anymore and being like, hey, do you want some help? And them just having to be like, yeah, actually that would be great. I do enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really enjoying the introduction of the Imperial Senator character.
Mm-hmm.
who just wants someone to be able to make a damn decision around here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I find all of that stuff really, really fun. So it's like as long as I don't like think too hard about the bigger picture, I'm enjoying myself, which is maybe the opposite of like what it should be doing, but hey.
Yeah, I'm having a great time with it.
Yeah, it's cool. The politicking stuff and the great balance I find very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that with the author specifically, I'm very interested in the balance, which I think that from what I can tell from the couple things we know about it is that it's like I think she says something about Luke being a Jedi means that like other people are not Jedi. I don't know. It's a little confusing.
It's from what I gathered from like the brief like description of it in the book, it's like they believe the Force is real and mm-hmm. they can like attune to it or whatever, but they believe that like everyone gets like the amount of Force or like the Force moves the way it's going to move, and that if you're like a Jedi or if you're like using it, if you're like controlling it, then you're like removing somebody else's opportunity yeah. to be like visited by or like be, you know, affected by. I actually do find that kind of interesting as mm-hmm. like a philosophical counterpoint to the Jedi who are like measuring and using and like Force as a finite resource is an interesting philosophical stance. I don't mm-hmm. know how that's going to hold up like as a like how are they gonna spin that into like a full story, but it's a cool idea, I think.
Do you think that she's being like set up to like change her mind about her beliefs?
I'm curious about that. Gabriel. I don't know, because there's the boring version of this where she is the reasonable Imperial, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just how it goes. The interesting version of this to me is either like she does kind of have to reckon with her beliefs and change her mind, or she ends up kind of like putting her foot down and being unable to step out of like that mindset, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so difficult to guess like how author voice is the description of her political leanings versus carefully crafted because I love the paragraph where it sort of like outlines her politics, mm-hmm. But I don't know if it's just the author describing her own politics, right? Her like, because it's a really great summation of like the apolitical political person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Before the Empire arrived, Bacora had been governed by a prime minister and a senate, and no set of three individuals in the government could ever agree on a program. Schools had run half year when Gary started attending, then shifted to a tumble month schedule, two on and one off. Again, really funny shit to be in Star Wars. We're not talking... Star Wars is not a universe where we are talking about tumble month schedule. What the fuck is going on here? Then someone scrapped the entire curriculum. If the government couldn't agree on a school calendar, even a child knew it wouldn't agree on anything else. As a senator's daughter and the prime minister's niece, she'd overheard unending machinations and bickering about other subjects. Social justice, repulsor lift exports, and taxation. So, like, that's a really fun way to summarize this character's politics, right? Like, mm-hmm. like completely immersed in politics, but sees herself as sort of, like, above or beyond it, or just like they just nothing's getting done because nobody agrees type shit, right? You're a senator right? Like very very funny position for her to be in, and I hope they do something interesting with that, because I love that. I do really like that.
And she's also set up to be Luke's love interest, right?
She is the beautiful woman who he notices in the briefing
yeah.
room, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes. Yeah, that's interesting, because as a expanded universe reader, I know that they do not end up together.
She's not going to make it out of this book, I don't think.
She's not making it out of this book. She is no Mara Jade.
No.
So yeah, very curious where she's gonna end up. But yeah, she I knew I was in for a treat when we got to her first chapter, and it was like describing her sitting in this room as sort of like judging all of the other Imperial. The other kinds of Imperial who are in the room, right? Mm-hmm. And just like when I love it whenever there's like intra-faction politicking, right? Like mm-hmm. I know you haven't seen Andor, but like Andor, half of Andor is people in the Empire arguing with each other, like just people in various like offices in the Empire, like trying to outmaneuver each other, and I love that kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So her just sort of going like, oh yeah, this guy is a really annoying, this guy is a really great, you know, this guy has so much poise, this guy is so reasonable, where as opposed to this guy who's really, oh I hate him, he's the description she has of is it Velaris, like the guy who's the very fastidious guy with the gloves, right? Mm-hmm. I love that stuff. Again, very Star Trek, very like the Imperials being characters at all in this is very interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That I think is maybe the most promising part for me. That and the bizarre dinosaur stuff, which we haven't really talked about yet.
Yeah. Very weird dinosaur stuff.
The entechment procedure and Dev and his master. What's going on there?
I'm not sure. It's very interesting.
It's very, very odd, isn't it?
Is he in love with his dinosaur master?
Is he in love with the dinosaur? I really get the sense that there's something going on there. Like, it's very... There is a twinge here, and you know this. We're only a third of the way through the book, so who knows how how things will pan out. I think I feel fairly comfortable saying that I'm detecting a twinge of the gay villain here. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's a little. I think that the maybe the most, and it might be. It's too early to call it completely uncomfortable, because I don't know where they're going with it, right? But I think the most thing that I've like put a pin in so far here mm-hmm. is the portrayal of Dev and his desire to be a droid, right? Or in fact, not even just a droid, to be anything other than a human, right?
Right.
It describes this. It never says dysphoria or anything, but like there are multiple scenes where he like wishes he was a droid. That's his goal is to become intact because he wants to be a powerful battle droid. And then there's mm-hmm. another scene when like the ship that he's on does a maneuver that requires them all to brace, and he's like, oh, if you know, he thinks about how much he would prefer to have a Siruk body in that scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm detecting like maybe a little hint of like Hannibal villain, you know, like Silence of the Lambs type stuff here, maybe.
Right.
He's certainly portrayed with a little bit he's portrayed so far with like a little bit of like sad compassion, right? There's the very funny scene when Luke and Leia and Han are in that meeting and they're shown the like the infomercial that Dev basically sent everyone on Bakura for like mm-hmm. why becoming a droid is really cool, which is, and everyone's just like, damn, this guy is like really young, what's going on with this guy, which is it's a very, you know, there like there's some sympathy for him and his situation and his like the way he is being kind of used by the Siruk, but I do look at it and go like, I don't know, Christian evangelical author writing about this confused young man, you know, where is this going? And I don't, many places that aren't good are possible, right?
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. And I mean, I see like an obvious path where it's like he's brought over to the good guys, which I think that he will be. And then he's like becomes normal, right?
Which would also be, you know, he gets over all of that. Oh,
exactly.
We'll see. But it's at the very least, purely on paper, it is he's a very interesting character, and his relationship with what's his dinosaur master's name?
Ferrowung.
Yes, everyone has very like long bird sound names, which are very cool. And if you go to the author's website, there is an FAQ thing. It's like, how do you pronounce this? And she says, I don't really mind how you pronounce it. So thanks. Thank you very much.
Great.
She didn't really think too hard about that one, I guess. But yes, no, he has this weird relationship where he is constantly eager to please his master, who is, I mean, like, is outwardly rather kind to him, right?
Yeah.
Even though they're doing insane Frankenstein experiments on guys. And he's, you know, he's just constantly thinking about how powerful and handsome and majestic this dinosaur is, right? So yeah, there's gay villain undertones here.
Yes,
big
for
time.
Sure.
Which are, I'm curious, you know, I'm tenting my fingers, curious to see where you take this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have some guesses, maybe some prejudices based on the political and social views of the author, but hey, you know, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, a very weird thing for Star Wars.
Yes, it is very strange.
A very, very strange thing for Star Wars. Semi-related, but not just something. Just thinking of you know, power dynamics and sexual dynamics in Star Wars here.
Mm-hmm.
What's with the part where Luke notes that the Imperial guy has the will to dominate?
Like, several times, reaching out in the forest and finding out, like, this guy wants to dominate other people.
Luke's just, like, natural twink instincts kicking in. He's just going like, ooh, this guy, hold on. This guy's got the will to dominate me. Okay.
That's right.
Very, very funny. Yeah, I mentioned it before, but that the devs Entekment infomercial may be my favorite part of the book so far.
Yeah.
They hacked every channel on the planet and gave a big speech about how, like, hey, great news, everyone. I'm coming with my dinosaur buds and we are going to put you into these robots, which will make you strong and powerful. Isn't that great? Okay, bye. Really fun. Really, really cute.
It's very cute. I can't imagine what strategic benefit that gives them, but I guess psychological warfare.
It makes for a great. Well, no, you're letting them. It's like when you get a flyer telling you that there's a garage sale happening next week. Just right. Letting you know, I will be coming by and strapping you to a chair and putting your brain into a robot. That's
right.
Just how it is. It's going to be great. Great, great news for everyone. I don't see what the problem is. I found that very, very. That's like the most like. A credible threat the villains have seemed so far, because the droids aren't particularly interested. Like all the tactics stuff with the droids, nah, not that interesting. But I appreciate that it's at least, I guess, kind of a small scale conflict on like confined, like planets are basically states in Star Wars anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah, this is just like a thing, a weird thing happening in a border town somewhere. That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Very funny that Luke and Leia and Han from Star Wars have to be involved in this Star Trek episode about it, though.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the weird part of this, but they sure are there. General Solo is there on the mission.
Yeah, that's a strong first third of this book, I think. Very,
yeah.
Very silly, very weird, but a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess next time we'll be reading the next seven chapters, right? That's our next goal.
Yep.
All right. Our theme song is Hot McGonagall by Cheshire Moon. Huge thanks to them, as always, for letting us use it as our theme song. You can find them on Bandcamp, and you can find us at patreon.com/shriekcast. And Liz, I know I just asked you, but I'm going to ask it again. What are we reading next time?
We are reading the next seven chapters of Truce at Bakura.
That's next seven chapters of Truce at Bakura. And until then, may the force be with you.
May the force be with you.
Hey.
If you go into the dream, but there's a lady there, makes ocean roar seem tame. Better know what you're after if you catch her eye. Cause this hot mama is just a cat in disguise.